Here's golf legend John Daly.
Hell yeah, these wins are piling up faster than my divorces.
I only spent on Moto, America's social casino. You know I've won a couple of majors. And on Moto, I've won majors, grands, and epic jackpots on their classic Vegas slots with huge, huge bonus rounds. Moto Casino adds new games and awards players free coins every single day. Grip it and spin it on Moto Casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.
Second hour, Darren Donick and Chase here on ESPN 102.5 The Game, here on this beautiful day here in Nashville. Man, Middle Tennessee is sunny. It's going to be 82, 83 degrees today as we sit here in late October. Great discussion with former Predators captain Mike Fisher last hour. Don't forget Tim Hasselbeck, his weekly chat with us coming up at high noon. But first, let's head up to Toronto. Let's bring in Richard Deitch from The Athletic. We were talking about you on Monday's show. We were sad to hear the news that Mike Doc Emrick has decided after 90 years of doing NHL broadcasts that he is going to retire. And we kind of reflected on all of our encounters with him over the years and his appearances on this show and just being around him and things you've written about him. But for us, it was a sad day. We knew it would come to an end sometime. But it's going to be weird next season not to hear him behind the mic.
Well, first, good to be with you guys. You really, given your lineup coming up, you really could do much better than me as a guest. But still, I appreciate the invite all the same. Mike Emrick is one of the rare broadcasters, and you saw this the day that the news came out, where he announced his retirement. Where like the reaction was essentially universally positive about his career, universally appreciative about how he approached his job. It's very rare in 2020 to find universal opinion about anything, including a sports broadcaster. But Mike Emrick was that. He was the voice of the NHL for generations. So really, depending irrelevant of your age, generally speaking, for the most part, Mike Emrick has been the soundtrack of hockey if you're a hockey fan. His style was incredibly unique in that he was able to do frantic, probably better than any broadcaster I've ever seen. And he sort of used that with the ability to throw in some verbs and words you might never have heard of. The passion and joy and love of hockey was clearly apparent regardless of the game he played. And then here's the last one. This is actually important because this won't necessarily be the case as broadcasters head forward. Mike Emrick grinded before he got into the quote-unquote majors. He was a college hockey announcer. He announced for, I think, 6 or 7 years in the AHL and the minor leagues, and then eventually got a job as a team announcer, I think first for either the Flyers or the Devils. I have to check his bio again. And so this is not a guy who became like a national broadcaster, like, you know, at 30 or 29 or 31, which we, you know, really see today in Adam Amin or Joe Buck or someone like that. So his career is just so unique in that, like, you can sort of close your eyes and imagine this guy like grinding in the minor leagues like Slapshot, you know what I mean, like with a little tape recorder covering these games until he got to the big time, until he got to, you know, to become the guy at NBC. And I think that kind of experience just makes him so unique in the business. He'll be missed. He's really a brilliant broadcaster and a very, very his reputation in the business is incredible. He's been on your show, I know. He's really considered a generous and very nice man, and he deserves all the acclaim that he's received.
I'm glad you said that because, look, I get it. I'm not going to be phony about this, but I had to go through a grind, and I appreciated the grind, and it probably makes me appreciate it even more today. I don't ever take this for granted because I don't, you know, I'm certainly not going to get into the stories of all the little, you know, trailers and AM stations that I started off in and the grind and overnights and all that good stuff, because if I could have just landed a big cushy job right out of the gates, I would have taken it. But I do think that's a little bit missing. I bring that up to say I do, because we all now, and I'm certainly not going to pigeonhole all young people today and young adults and say those damn millennials and turn into get off my lawn guy and say they all want it now and fast. And because, you know, if I could have had it fast and then back then, I would have done that too. But I do think you lose the appreciation of the grind and you lose the appreciation. If you really didn't go through stuff like what you're talking about, the older you get, and for the people, you know, good for them if they do land the big jobs in, you know, their early 20s or mid-20s or what have you, and they don't really go through that true grind that you're talking about. I do think it's something that's a little bit missing today because, you know, a lot of people today, they just want it now. They don't want to wait. They don't want to go through a process. They just want it now.
Yeah, I mean, you know, the business is sort of cratered, too, so there's not even as many of those smaller jobs anymore, let alone
True.
Big jobs. My career is a little bit of both, if I'm just going to be 100% honest with your audience. When I graduated from University of Buffalo, which is where I went to undergrad, I worked for a couple of years in Buffalo making essentially no money, $10 a story for a weekly. So I literally had to write 20 stories a week to pay my rent. Thankfully, Buffalo was a pretty cheap city to live in back then, so my rent wasn't crazy. But that was a grind. I mean, 2 years of going in, like, you know, like -5 degree weather with snowstorms to cover, like, you know, high school football or, you know, in the worst conditions you can imagine. I was fortunate to cover the Bills and the Sabres as a very, very young person in the business, and that was helpful. So, you know, I did grind in that sense for a couple of years. Now, that said, and this is where it flips, I worked for Sports Illustrated in my mid-20s. You know, I got pretty lucky just in terms of they liked my stuff. I went to a pretty prestigious grad school, and which put me in the same city as Sports Illustrated. So I have been a massive beneficiary of getting a big-time job or working at a big-time place in my 20s. At the same time, you know, I do understand the grind. I did have to grind for a couple of years before, you know, sort of luck landed on me. And then obviously at The Athletic, the same thing. I'm working for a pretty prestige brand. So I've seen it both ways, but I think that I happen to agree with you in that I'm not one who's like, oh, you got to earn your dues, you know, son. You can't, if I think anybody can get a job at 22, that's a big time job, they should take it. But I do think there, if you have sort of had to struggle a little bit, if nothing else, I think you do appreciate the big job more.
I don't know your timeline real quick before I pass this to Willie. Were you there in school when was Pete Weber up there doing his work in Buffalo when you were there in school?
Yeah, I mean, he left the city around. Yeah, I mean, our paths crossed. Let me say this: our paths crossed a little bit. I think
okay.
He was out of town by the time that. When did he come to Nashville? Do you remember the date?
Well, he came to Nashville, but there were stops after. He came to Nashville in 90, the first season of the Predators.
Which was 98.
98.
98. Okay, so yeah. So he basically, our paths may have crossed in Buffalo for like a year before
okay.
He jetted to Nashville. But I know him. I know Pete. And Pete's a great guy. Pete's always been, was always kind to me when I was really super young because he used to do the Bisons.
Yes,
if I remember right, and
yeah.
So I would see him there, the AAA team.
You know, he knows Buster.
Might have been the Pirates back then.
Richard, he knows Buster. Just so you know, he will give
yes,
you. He will.
Yeah.
You can do an interview with Buster. Pete will set that up if you ever need to.
Pete is Buffalo. He remains Buffalo.
And happy anniversary, Pete and Claudia.
Yeah, nice.
Yeah, that's right.
Anniversary.
Yeah,
31st
yeah.
anniversary.
But yeah, no, I mean the again like. You know, I think in broadcasting, I think even there's a challenge to be a broadcaster as Pete was to sort of introduce a new market to a sport. And, you know, you have a really important role there in terms of, you know, in terms of what you do. Interestingly enough, if I was the Seattle Kraken broadcaster, and I don't know if they've named that person yet, one of the first calls I would make would be to Pete Weber because I would want to know, what were those first couple of seasons like to not only call the games, but in a sense to sort of educate the community a little bit on this new sport. And Pete had one of these life experiences that don't often happen. Most of the times you're a sports broadcaster, you know this, Willie. You go to a market where the sport's established. You got to be the person to establish yourself as the talent or your style. But Pete coming to Nashville, it wasn't just, hey, here's a new broadcaster. Also, hey, here's a new sport that really doesn't have a long history in this city. And, you know, here's the guy who's essentially not only going to call the games, he's going to help teach you the sport.
No question. And I think we have said for a long time that And I think they thought they had this in mind when they hired Pete and Terry Crisp, but you could not have two better ambassadors for that particular role that you just described than those two guys. They were probably more valuable than any player because the players were all unknowns, right? Most hockey players in general were unknown to the fan base, but even to hockey fans, the expansion guys were unknown players, right? It's not that they brought in some guys that anybody had ever heard of. So Pete and Terry were the guys who carried it and just made it, you know, made it fun, made it personable, and all that stuff.
Yeah, and then, you know, again, I would never equate this to this because it's not fair because nobody is like Vin Scully. But Vin Scully was essentially ambassador to baseball in Los Angeles when the Brooklyn Dodgers moved to L.A., and Scully educated an entire fan base. But not only that, was essentially the brand ambassador for that brand. That, I mean, you know, when you associated that team before any players, you associated – the broadcaster in that situation. It's one in a way, amazingly enough, in 2020, you know, in this crazy freaking time we're living in, a local broadcaster, a team broadcaster, still has a lot of cachet and a lot of importance in a community. Like that voice, whether it's on radio, whether it's on television, like still has significant meaning, which is interesting because that was the exact same thing if we had this conversation in 1923. 1943 or 1963. It's like the connection still exists, even though we live in this modern world.
Richard Deitch is with us from The Athletic. And Richard, you had a good conversation on one of your latest posts on The Athletic, talking to television directors and how they are trying to go about showing things. And you focused on the NFL, but you really could have done it for any sport. But when people are watching an NFL game, I think it'd be interesting to keep this in mind of what the director is trying to show you to bring out the game in its best way, knowing that there's not as many fans in the stands.
Yeah, I mean, the biggest change in talking to, and basically I talked to the directors who direct the top games, the director of Nance Romo, director of Collinsworth Michaels, et cetera, et cetera. And so what they said, the biggest difference, obviously, of course, is that they're doing this under COVID-19 protocols. So everything is socially distanced. They're working with a mask in the truck. Like their whole like sort of work environment has changed. So sort of keep that in mind. How that impacts you as a viewer is because there's no crowd, they're shooting the game much, much lower. If you've noticed, you don't often see the wide shots that you normally would see in the NFL where maybe they sort of like, you know, they'd bring you down like almost like a Skycam view and then come all the way down to the behind the quarterback to give you like scale, especially if the quarterback's in an opposing stadium, to give you like a scale of how loud it is for that quarterback or how tough an environment it is. Those shots really are not existing this year. They're very much like sort of what they say they call tight on the field. They're really, really trying to stay tight on the field. One of the things that, because of COVID-19, that probably is a little bit of a benefit for viewers given the directors, is because there's not a ton of crowd, they're able to put camera operators in the stands, and they're able to shoot some angles, particularly low angles, that they never could shoot before because there would normally be fans there. And then the other thing, we talked a lot of other things, but sort of the other thing that was pretty notable to me was these guys love to get coaches' reaction shots. Obviously, something happens in the game, and, you know, whether it's a Belichick or, you know, Mike Vrabel or whoever, they react to it. Because coaches are wearing masks, it makes it a much tougher decision for the director to go on that shot because you're not really going to get a reaction unless the coach throws a clipboard or really makes some kind of movement where you can sort of see what they're thinking. So just their whole philosophy and their whole mindset has changed in terms of just how they're directing a game, because the game in 2020 is just very different than it was in any other year.
We're talking to Richard Deitch of The Athletic, and I know what I'm about to bring up probably will never happen because it makes too much sense in my opinion, but because of COVID, we've now seen, you know, a couple of games shifted. We've now had two Monday night doubleheaders, the week one that they usually have on ESPN, and then we saw it this week. I would love to see the Thursday night game go away and have two Monday night games. Do you think because the NFL has been forced to have to move stuff around this year that they see the product, they hear from fans on it, do you think that it actually could have a chance of happening, whether it's next season or with the next TV deal?
I think my short answer is no, because I don't necessarily like fundamentally disagree with you. Thursday Night Football hasn't popped like the way – I mean, how do I sort of phrase this? I mean, at the end of the day, I'll just be honest. Like, they're not going to change it because there's too much money that they've been paid for Thursday Night Football. Like, they've established a market. They can get paid an inordinate amount of money for it. The league and the players have already sort of agreed to play on that night, so I don't see it changing. I do understand where you're coming from. It does feel, even today, it sort of still feels odd to me. It just feels like this odd one-off. And, like, I will certainly watch the game, but, you know, I think the game sometimes pops if it's, like, two great teams, and then other times, you know, felt like forever. It was like the Browns versus the Jets, and you're like, oh, my God, you know, why is this game even happening today? So I don't think it'll change. In terms of the Monday Night Football doubleheader, which I think, like, logically makes more sense because it connects to the Sunday schedule, the reason I don't think you will ever see that is because I think the NFL does not want to have a 10 o'clock Eastern time kickoff. So 7 p.m., let's say, Pacific time, if you're in the – you know, obviously there, 8 o'clock in the, you know, like in Denver, et cetera, 9 o'clock where you guys would be. Because the viewership numbers ultimately at a certain point do drop. Once you get around 11:30 or so in the Eastern time zone, like data has shown for years and years and years, the audience really does drop. And I think they would be worried in terms of the viewership numbers, in terms of the optics, and ultimately in terms of charging networks more money for the product. I think they'd be a little bit too worried about the Monday Night Football doubleheader not producing the viewership numbers they'd want. You could sort of reverse it and do the interesting one, like, okay, what happens if you went like a 5 p.m. kind of Eastern time kickoff and then an 8 p.m. Eastern time kickoff? That's kind of interesting to me. But then right. I think you'd have to have, like, honestly, that 5 o'clock game would almost have to be great teams, I think, to get people to watch. Like, you'd have to have Bills Chiefs, or you'd have to have Titans Patriots. I think if that game turned out to be a dog, you know, you could be looking at like 6.5 million people watching instead of 12, and that's not a number I think the NFL watches. So that would be the downside risk on that, is that the you know, the viewership numbers are too early. That said, a 5 p.m. kickoff, I feel like, would be so friendly to fans, and I think, you know, you'd be able to get home and still, like, you know, get home at a decent time. You'd be able to tailgate, you know, you take off from work and just make it a fun day. But I'm not sure if I see it. It's an interesting idea. I just don't know if I see it.
Well, and I've always thought of it because I know now Disney and, you know, they want to get ABC kind of back in the fold and try and get a Super Bowl. And so you put one game on ESPN, one game on ABC, it you know, it might work for them if they were to do it that way whenever the next TV deal, you know, I know it's a few years before that's up.
Yeah, what's going to be interesting is sort of like ultimately what happens in this new contract, and would they be willing to do some different things that they didn't do before? My one prediction, and trust me, this ain't a genius prediction, is that ABC will be getting a Super Bowl. I think ESPN has done everything in its you know, in its power to try to get a better relationship with the NFL. I mean, you know, short of basically giving Roger Goodell the ESPN campus as a gift. So, like, that relationship has gotten much better. And this is where, like, this whole business is just insane. So ESPN will give the NFL the pleasure of the $2 million check they write just to get into the Super Bowl rotation. But I think they will. So you will see ABC for sure get a Super Bowl game, and I think ultimately we are not far away from ABC simulcasting all the ESPN games. The reason why that has not happened is ESPN, of course, to justify the $9 that you pay as a subscriber for ESPN and to justify, you know, their place in the cable universe and charging cable operators all this money, they've kept the NFL game on ESPN because they want to increase the value of ESPN. They want to make ESPN valuable enough where all these cable operators have to have the that station or that network on. I think, though, that the NFL is ultimately going to insist on the simulcast because it's better for the NFL. Your listeners, you know, they don't live in this world as much as I do, but it really makes a massive difference. I know, Willie, you know this. When you have a game on a network, like an ABC, an NBC, or CBS, even in 2020, versus a cable place like an ESPN or an FS1, it is a game changer on viewership. And I think the NFL is going to insist on wanting that.
Yeah. Well, we'll see how it plays out for sure. Richard, we appreciate the time as always, and we will talk to you again here pretty soon.
Thanks, Richard.
All right. Book better guests than me next time. Thanks.
Richard Deitch of The Athletic talking to the media circus.
We've got him on the A-list. We've got Richard on the A-list.
He's totally on the A-list. Totally on the A-list. We'll talk to Caleb Joseph coming up at the bottom of the hour. More coming. Darren Donick and Chase, ESPN, 102.5 The Game.
Well, this fast-moving show continues to roll right along. Mike Fisher we had in the first hour. You just heard Richard Deitch from The Athletic, and now Blue Jays catcher and Nashvillean Caleb Joseph. Caleb, how you doing?
What's going on? Been a while.
It has been a while. What have you been up to?
Oh, just doing baseball things, doing yard work, running errands, taking out the trash, all the fun things we get to look forward to when baseball season's over.
Oh, you're a human. After baseball, you're a human being?
Yeah.
Okay, you do normal stuff?
Tough transition, but, you know, it takes about a week to get back into it, but we're in good shape.
You don't swipe one of the equipment guys or something, bring him home and make him do all the chores?
I've thought about it. It's amazing. Get home and start knocking out that honey-do list, and before you blink, it's three times larger than when it started.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how it works. Before we get into World Series stuff, how was this awkward year, this weird season that nobody ever thought we would ever talk about when it comes to a Major League Baseball season, but how was it going through it?
It was pretty odd, Darren. It was, I had experience playing with no fans in the stands.
You have.
One game, but to do an entire season with nobody there was just odd. I hope it never happens again. I'm very happy that we were able to get through the 60-game season, that so far it looks like we're going to get through the postseason. And that's really was our ultimate goal, but it was odd. It was weird. It wasn't as much fun. Glad that we did it. Glad that the fans were able to see it on TV. But from a player's perspective, it didn't really meet expectations in terms of what we're used to. And, you know, sometimes you forget how much energy and passion and emotion that the fans bring to the stadiums each and every night. And, boy, it was tough getting going every day, the protocols, routines, being kind of locked away from everybody else. It just, for me personally, it wasn't as fun. And hope that we can get back to normal next year.
Yeah, we had Kurt Casale on. I guess we're going back-to-back days with MLB catchers. And he said the same thing. Like, you had to do what you had to do to get through this season. But I think you probably all feel this way. Like, you don't ever want to do that again. No fans. It's just not the same. I even talked to him about, do you have to change things up because you don't have the normal distractions going on, right, throughout the course of a game. Certain ballparks are sold out. They're packed. It's loud. There's, you know, constant stuff going on. And now you're in this, you know, quiet environment with piped-in stuff. Did you actually, you know, I didn't know if it was a silly question or not, but did you have to actually change some things because you don't have any of that going on around you?
I wouldn't say a ton there, but you do have to watch your mouth.
Yeah, he said that. He told a story,
right?
Yeah. Like talking in the dugout, like you can normally badmouth the umpire, you know, in the dugout, nobody can hear. And he said they got caught doing that, and he came over and said, shut the you-know-what up.
Yeah, that's those type of things you have to adjust in terms of actual game situation stuff. It was like playing a backyard sandlot game all over again, and you know where you kind of everybody can hear everybody talking, and you try and mouth words versus actually speaking. Whereas during the season, you know, you get that crowd noise. It was, you know, for some of the young kids that made their debuts this year, I almost feel bad for them because they're experiencing the big leagues, they're experiencing that for the first time, but it's not even remotely close to what it feels like. I mean, just playing in that playoff game versus Tampa in that arena for two games in Tampa, a wild card series it was unbelievable. I'm going, this is just incredible that this is a playoff series. There's 100 fans here. There's no media. There's no nothing. You guys have no idea how amazing this experience really is, but it is about a 10% of what it really normally feels like, looks like, smells like, all of it. So I felt bad for him, but you just have to do what you can during that season.
That team you're on, that Blue Jays team, was a fun team to watch. Did you sense that, you know, obviously they've got some young kids that, you know, people recognize their names and they grab your attention and it looks like the future is incredibly bright. But what was your experience like with Toronto this year?
Yeah, their team is stacked. I mean, I've never seen anything like it before with so many young, above average major leaguers in terms of potential, outlook, stuff, moxie, attitude, instincts. I'm incredibly impressed with what, you know, the GM and president and the staff there in Toronto have been able to do in terms of getting 15 to 18 guys with 5 years of team control. It reminds me a little bit of kind of what the Rays have done a little bit in terms of how their roster is set to compete for not only just this year and have to restart and get that free agent and get this and fill this hole and that hole, but they have incredible team control for the next 3 to 5 years. This is exactly what Toronto has done. It didn't surprise me one bit when you just look at the overall stuff. What surprised me the most was the way that everybody kind of carried themselves and the way they approached the season. It didn't feel like 15 to 18 first-year players, first-year rookies. Incredibly impressed by Biggio, Bichette, and Guerrero. These kids are – it's amazing how the different approach that they bring, because they've been around the game since probably birth.
Yeah.
And been around that level since birth.
Mm-hmm.
And their instincts are just incredible. I mean, light years ahead of where I was when I got to the big leagues. And
that's
it was really,
that's interesting.
Really cool.
Yeah.
Really
that's,
cool.
That's interesting that you bring that up, Kayla, because we've talked about that on the show, because, you know, what that does, how much of an advantage is that? You know, I think when we first started talking, I'll never forget, Willie, you'll remember this. We were at Centennial Sportsplex. We were there for a Predators training camp, and Peter LaViolette came over and sat down at our table, and we did a really long interview with him, and it was coming off like basically Patrick Mahomes bursting onto the scene and, you know, just tearing it up. And I was asking him about the advantages a kid growing up in a locker room, albeit another sport, because dad played baseball, right?
Yes.
But what that does for, you know, my kid is not going to grow up in locker rooms because dad doesn't play. Dad may talk sports. Dad doesn't play sports. And what kind of advantage that is for a kid. Like you said, those kids all grew up, you know, their whole lives running around in locker rooms, right, in clubhouses. And what kind of advantage that is, because you didn't have that.
Exactly. Huge advantage. And for a very long time. I think you're talking about between 14 and 20 years that each one of those
right.
guys were playing in the big leagues. It's not a cup of coffee. This is a huge chunk of their childhood. And it was pretty odd. I went up to Vladimir when I first saw him back in spring training 2.0 in Toronto, and I had to remind him, hey, you know, I have actually played in a spring training game with your dad on the same team. Now I get to hit both Vladimir Guerrero's up. So that was, you know, in my head and in my brain, I'm still like 23. I'm right in it with these guys. I mean, I've just been drafted. I'm coming up. I'm part of the core. But, you know, reality is I'm 34 years old, and I've actually played with his dad, you know. So it was unique, but huge. You can just tell they're incredibly comfortable, and I don't really know how. I love metaphors and being able to try and bring metaphors to situations where other people could understand, but I really can't have one here in terms of just the comfort level. It's not as if you walk into a major league clubhouse as a 12-year-old, 15-year-old, and you just magically have the gifts, but it's just it'd be like going, you know, somewhere for the first time, not knowing, that kind of anxiety, just a little bit. And then seeing, oh, this is not that bad. I feel like I can do this. I fit in. This is comfortable for me. And then doing that every day for a long time. And so when that opportunity comes, it is as second nature as possible. And so you feel fit right in. But those guys, they were amazing. I was I was very impressed with especially that trio.
We're talking to Toronto Blue Jays catcher Caleb Joseph, longtime big league catcher, grew up right here in Middle Tennessee, Franklin High School, Lipscomb University. Caleb, you will appreciate this. You're probably the best person to put it into words, especially today. The impact of Mookie Betts, without just looking at his batting average and the home runs, last night he changed the game with the two stolen bases and the great base running, scoring on the chopper to first with the infield in. Take us into the mind of the catcher when a guy like that gets on base, and you got a pitcher like Glasnow who's got a little command issue. You're trying to get him locked in, but just the distraction that he provides. I thought that was everything to that game.
It is. It changed the complexion of it. Changed the momentum. Changed everything. And that's what heady instinctual players do. They know the times are there. Glasnow's 1-5, 1-6 of the plate, could care less really about holding them on, cares more about throwing 100 miles an hour. And reality is you have a guy that can run, has great instincts, knows the game, has practiced it very, very routinely, and is not going to run wild, knows what he's doing, gets out there. You turn a walk or a base hit or something into a triple. And when you get a guy like that on base, you know, your main goal is to keep them off base, because you know anything that allows them to get to first base is now basically a triple. And a guy standing on third base, because you have really no shot as a catcher. You have no chance. You could have the best arm in the world, the fastest transfer in the world, and you just don't have the time. It's impossible. And to ask a player like Glasnow to change everything in game one of a World Series just to keep a runner on is not going to happen. And so Mookie knows that. He's going to take full advantage of it and turns it into a triple. Now you basically have a very softly, well, wouldn't say softly, but a ground ball that ends up scoring a run when, if he doesn't do that, possibly double play. Are we having this conversation? Who knows? So incredibly instinctual play. It's what winning plays look like. And this guy's brought a different look to this Dodgers team. They're tough. They're really tough. And they've always, I guess the last 4 or 5 years, they've been really solid with a lot of the same players you've had. Something about getting Mookie has just sent them over the top. And you can tell the way they look at him. They look at him as if he is the guy. And everybody said, well, yeah, Caleb, he's got $300-some million, you know, to be the guy. But there's a lot of great players on that team, too, and he came in and looked like he just took the reins as a leader. And I'm happy for him, because I really like Mookie a lot.
You know, and there's very few guys like him. We all know that. He's very special. But I just would love to see a little more of that ingredient thrown into the game. Like it was in my generation growing up, there was more emphasis on the running game. It just is action. It's fun to watch, right? There's stuff going on there. But, you know, you can't, as they say, you got to be able to get on base. You can't steal first base. And I know what they're looking for now, but, boy, I love the element of action that he brings in.
You're trying to get me in trouble, Willie.
I know everybody. This is always the old school, to get off my lawn, guys. But, you know, the game, we love the action that part of the game brings, and it has been de-emphasized a little bit, fair to say.
100%. I'm 100% agreement with you. I don't care. I'm like I said, I'm 34, probably on my way out. I'll speak my mind. I don't give a rip. I think the game needs more of this. The game is boring right now between me and you and whoever's listening. The game is boring. It's strikeouts, walks, and home solo homers, two-run, three-run homers. It's just a boring game. And you know what the problem is? It's because the other stuff, like you just said, the hitting and run, the walks, the hit the ball to the other, you know, to the opposite field with a guy at second base, less than two outs, get him over, get him on, get him over, get him in. The action of the game that kept it very three pitches or less, get the guys out in three pitches or less, you know, no walks, no, who cares about strikeouts like Bull Durham, you know, whatever, Crash Davis, be more democratic, you know, don't strike everybody out. Those type of elements of the game, I wouldn't say devalued, but they're not, you don't get compensated for that stuff. So the players, essentially, hey, what am I going to get paid for? Homers, strikeouts, those type of things. So everybody's going and reaching for that, and it's turned the game into kind of a boring game, really, to be honest with you. And that action is what people loved about baseball, is because you could score 15 different ways, whereas now, look at the stats. I think I saw one a couple of days ago, 60% or something, 70% of the runs scored in the World Series were via the home run.
The Rays, the entire postseason, they're over 70% of their runs scored by the home run.
And don't get me wrong, I love the homer too, but what changed that game last night, which nobody really, really talk about, unless you're a smart guy like Willie Donning, is that stolen base, you know? Is the stolen base. It just changed everything. And if that was valued more, I think it'd be a much more exciting game and product, and people would kind of get back into it a little bit.
Can I follow up on that
sure.
real quick? Is that why you see, you know, one thing that drove me crazy watching the Dodgers and the Braves? The Braves would get guys on base and then, you know, with one or no outs, and then they couldn't bring them home.
Yeah.
Is that kind of the mental aspect of what you're talking about, of guys go up to the plate and they're like, oh, I got to hit it out. That's how I have to do this. It's not, you know, you see small ball kind of go away.
Right. And that is because you are being paid for OPS, on base plus slugging. They don't even put in the big leagues. I couldn't believe it this year. They don't even put your average up on the board anymore. They just put OPS and on base percentage plus slugging percentage. Most people with a 340 to 370, 380 on base, that's really good. The separator is the slugging. Slugging is, people think just homers, is just doubles, triples, homers, and even a single gets you 1,000 slug. So it's not necessarily hit out, but like, I want to be a slugger. That's kind of the thing that's going on right now. Hey, just slug the ball, slug it. So go for the homer. If you miss, you have a double. And I was watching that game too, Braves and Braves and Marlins, actually, and they got guys on second base with no outs, and they're swinging for the fences, but it's just because it's not valued. If people were paid to do those type of team fundamentals, they would do it in a heartbeat, but they're just not paid for it anymore. They're paid for other stuff, so I'm going to run after the stuff that gets me paid.
Yeah, and it's because I grew up, you know, as a Braves fan, so a National League fan, and, you know, watching small ball is – that's what I like. I like seeing just a base hit. The home runs, of course, you'll take that, but just the fundamentals of the game. So speaking of some of the different things that changed this year, do you think that the runner on second and extra innings, the DH across the board, do you see that stuff staying put and not going away?
I'll tell you, I could see the runner at second. I could see that staying. I was... You know, initially being of an older mindset, I was very hesitant towards thinking, I don't really know how I feel about this. But at the end of the day, one thing that does kill you is in the big leagues, over 162 is that 14-inning game, that 16-inning game, and you have to crush the bullpen. And quite honestly, the people it messes up the most are the kids in the bullpens of these teams that have options that may pitch two, three, four innings and extra innings, do an unbelievable job. And because the game went 14, 15 innings, they find themselves on the bus headed to AAA because they got options and they have to bus in fresh arms. So for me personally, when I started thinking about that, a lot of these games were ending one and two innings into extras. And if it saves a guy a job and having to not go down to AAA after doing a phenomenal job and possibly an extra inning game, that to me is worth it. And it just kind of speeds it up. I do appreciate that. The DH, great question. I like catching and trying to get a hitter out much more than a four-hole DH type like a Nelson Cruz. I'd much rather get a hitter out, but I do feel like it's adapted pretty well, and I think people like it, and they like the action that extra hitter can bring into a lineup.
I had one more about just kind of the setup this year. The, you know, you watching the transaction wire, so-and-so sent to the alternate site. What was the alternate site like? Were there simulated games? I mean, because you didn't have the minor leagues this year like we're used to having, and I know that, you know, they could look different moving forward, but what was that whole setup like for the teams?
So we actually played in Buffalo this year. We weren't allowed to play in Canada. That was
a
whole nother issue to begin with. They did an amazing job. Buffalo was incredible. They did a great job. But our alternate site was in Rochester. They had basically just enough for two teams, and they would have workouts. They would basically go through a normal day, workouts, batting practice, simulated games. Something wouldn't necessarily be nine innings. They'd have to have certain pitchers pitching on certain days rest, so that if they had a need in the big leagues, they weren't throwing everybody in terms of maneuverability. They had to do that. Sometimes it would be three innings. Sometimes it would be five innings. Hitters would go take your live cage sessions, take your ground balls. It was basically a like a spring training game, except you were inter-squatting with your own team. Fortunately, the Jays let me hang out in the big leagues all year, so I never had to go there. I was able to, without being on the, quote, active roster for the entire year, I was able, as a taxi squad player for most of the year, able to stay in the big leagues with them. So guys would tell me about how it was. They said it was great, but at the end of the day, there's no AAA, and you could tell that guys had been very comfortable hitting off their own teammates versus other pitchers when they got up to the big leagues.
Yeah, good stuff. Quickly, how do you see this playing out the rest of the way? Is this the Dodgers to lose?
You know, I think it is, to be honest with you, because in my heart, I really want them to win. I don't want the Rays to win. If you have two teams with very similar philosophies in terms of how they use analytics, I personally want the team with, you know, the $240 million payroll winning it, just to be honest with you. But they're stacked. They're deep. Boy, the Rays are deep, but I think it's their year.
Yeah. Cool. Hey, great to talk to you. Glad you're back home, and I'm sure we'll chat with you soon.
You got it. Thank you so much, fellas.
Thank you, Caleb. That is Caleb Joseph, Blue Jays catcher and Nashvillian, and always good to talk to him. Tim Hasselbeck coming up at high noon. Back to wrap up the second hour next. Good stuff from Caleb Joseph. Loaded show today. Man, we are just moving right along. Tim Hasselbeck coming up in about 10 minutes back here on Darren, Donick, and Chase on this Wednesday. Hope everybody's having a great day thus far. Very, very happy but sad news on the Predators front. Someone on the equipment side of things who we've gotten to know over the years, been there a long time, just got a big promotion, and we would like to throw out a hearty congrats. But like I said, also sad to see him go away. Willie, what can you tell us? Seattle Kraken have found their head equipment guy.
Yes, and this is great news. You know, we will miss this individual tremendously, but you love to see a guy move up, right? Jeff Camilio, who has been, ever since I've been traveling with the team as the team is one of the team's broadcasters, he's been one of the guys. I would call him the right-hand man for Pete Rogers.
No doubt.
On the equipment staff, and it is one of the most, unless you really see it up front and day to day, you have no idea what those guys do. You just think about the amount of equipment each hockey player has. Think about having a team where every player is a catcher in baseball, right? That's what each hockey player basically has catcher's equipment, yeah. Right? And then the goalie has even more than that. We know that. But Jeff Camilio is an unbelievable worker. And the other thing that you have to have, from my observation, to have that job, a fierce loyalty to the group, right? I mean, if you walk into their turf on the equipment staff, and this would go for any NHL locker room, right? You got to go through them, right? You better watch yourself. If you're out of line, they're going to let you know. And they're going to say, hey, you can't go over here. Or, hey, watch, you know, conduct yourself right. Because that loyalty the players see, and, you know, you talk about guys in the foxhole. Those guys are in the foxhole.
No doubt.
So Jeff Camilio has now been named the head equipment manager.
Head equipment manager
for the brand new Seattle Kraken.
That's
good,
awesome.
Great for Jeff. I mean, that
sad,
is, that's awesome.
Sad, but happy.
Yeah.
Sad.
So now we got
to
contact
go.
Out in Seattle when we actually get out there.
Well, he deserves it.
He does.
He so deserves it. And I'll just tell you this right now.
They work so hard.
He's a guy that, you know, you could see on Willie on your broadcast. He's a guy that you can see there on the bench. But he's one of those behind-the-scenes guys that does so much. And, you know, I just have always appreciated his conversations. There's at times there's a lot of standing around in the locker room. And there's times when I'm sitting there waiting to do a pregame interview, and I'm just standing around. It's part of it. And I've always appreciated, you know, he's at times been sitting there working on somebody's equipment at their locker when they're not there or what have you, or cleaning something up. And he just, me and him would just talk sports, anything.
Yep.
It wasn't just hockey. We would just talk.
Same here.
Sports. And I just always appreciated him, you know, because – you just, when you're standing there doing nothing, just waiting, and sometimes you can wait for 10, 15 minutes, he made the time go by. You know, we all of a sudden we just get wrapped up in a conversation, and then whoever I was waiting for, they're coming out of the shower or what have you, been working out, you know, wherever they have been elsewhere, they come up, and I just always appreciated his conversations over the years in the locker room. He's a great guy, and I can't think of anybody that deserves to be, you know, their shot to be a head equipment manager more than Jeff Camilio. And good for him. Now going out to Seattle. And so just wanted to say sad because I'll miss those conversations in the locker room, but really, really happy for him.
And he has obviously learned from one of the best in Pete Rogers, who's a day one guy. So now they got that in common. You know, Jeff can experience what Pete did back in 1998 when the Predators first started. Pete was one of the, you know, the first hires to be the equipment manager here with the Preds. And now Jeff can follow in his footsteps. And Jeff will be just fine because he can chirp just like the players. I've seen him give it to the guys in the locker room, and it's always entertaining because he can hold his own.
No question about that. You have to be able to do that for sure. But you earn the respect of your peers, and to do that job, you are respected. And, you know, you just think about the amount of equipment. I just had the picture of it, Darren, as you were describing it. It could be the visor on your helmet. It could be your skate
plate.
That's
usually what he was doing. He was cleaning visors, and he would just be standing there right by me when I'm just standing there. And while he's cleaning visors, he would just strike up a conversation. You know, we would just start talking sports.
Yeah, and it could be the strap on this pad or that pad, or I need a new this. Mm-hmm. And there's so many things. And then anytime you walk into that locker room, it is pristine. Right, as far as cleanliness and lockers, uniforms hanging up there, everything you need. It's an underappreciated. It's a fascinating job to see up close.
Yes,
so
it is.
Anything you get in that business, you earn.
Those
and
guys
you
work
have
their
to
butt
be
off
on it every day because you can't come to work or you can't go on a road trip and forget something. Right? You think about all that stuff that they're
in charge of
moving everybody's bag. It's not an option.
No.
So your attention to detail has to be a 10 out of 10.
Yeah, good for him. Really good guy. So happy for him. Head equipment manager, Seattle Kraken. So really, really cool. So wanted to pass along a hearty congrats to Jeff as he moves on to Seattle. But like I said, also a little bit sad. I'll miss those conversations, and I know you guys had the same types of conversations with him. He was just a really friendly guy, always had a smile on his face. And like you said, though, Chase, well said, could hold his own. You know, he wasn't afraid to give it back. So really, really cool. We'll come back. There is some news on the Titans front, by the way. In fact, let's go on and pass that along because we may have a little bit from Mike Vrabel in the third hour after Tim Hasselbeck. Chase, what do we have on a guy that hasn't been in the lineup yet?
Yes, the Tennessee Titans have designated for return cornerback Adoree Jackson from IR. So what this means, because of how the new rules with this, it opens up a 3-week window for him to practice. He can be a part of practices, be with the team, but he does not count against the 53-man roster until he is activated completely from IR. So it's kind of like a little bit of time for him to get reacclimated with things. He can practice, and then once he's ready to go, probably won't be this week, the Titans can activate him, and he will count against the 53. So Adoree Jackson, very close to returning to the lineup for the Titans.
We'll come back, start the third hour with Tim Hasselbeck next on ESPN 102.5 The Game.
Every dating app swipe is another loss. Gym bros, fake CEOs, straight up losers. So now the only app I open is Moto Casino because at least there I'm surrounded by winners, real winners, thousands of them. While everyone else is in the single swamp, I'm at home relaxing while stacking bonuses, hitting wins, and playing all my favorite Vegas style games. Moto Casino, the only app worth your time.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit Moto.us for more details. Download the Moto Casino app today. Must be 21 plus.
Moto Casino, America's social casino.